Turn then back to 1 Samuel. You might have guessed then that this evening I would like us to think about this great friendship of David and Jonathan. It's one of the most beautiful friendships in the scriptures. And I want us to do so by considering 3 points about this friendship. The first then, that this friendship of David and Jonathan was both a natural and an unnatural friendship. It was both natural and unnatural. It was natural in the sense that we read at the inception of the relationship there at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 17 as we have it. Jonathan then immediately forms a deep emotional and loving attachment to Jonathan, doesn't he? We read then that Jonathan then loved him, David, as his own soul. We read that in 18 verse 1, and we read it again in 18 verse 3, that he loved Jonathan, loved David as his own soul. The context then is then what we considered last week, this killing of Goliath by David and the victory then that Israel had over the Philistine army. And then on those couple of occasions, both when he volunteered to fight the Philistine, and then afterwards when he'd been successful, David met with Saul in his tent with other members of the kingly court there, including Jonathan, as we've just read. And Jonathan observed these valiant words that we thought about last week of David's commitment to the Lord, his bravery in going to fight this fierce giant, Philistine Goliath, and so on. And it was that and his commitment, David's commitment to the Lord then, that knit Jonathan's soul to the soul of David. There was then a naturalness about it. And this deep and mutual love, as it became, was there then throughout their lives together. So it was there, as I said, at the outset, and we read of it again, didn't we, in chapter 17, where again in chapter 20, where in verse 17, we again read of Jonathan as he meets with David. He loved him again, we read, as his own soul. And at the end of chapter 20, in verse 41, we read this language of them hugging each other and kissing each other because of their great love for each other. And after Jonathan's death, David expressed then his love in that lament we read at the beginning of the second book of Samuel. 2 Samuel 1 verse 26, we read David lamenting, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant you have been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." Of course, as many of you know, very sadly, there are people in our day who can't think of a friendship without thinking sexually. Most friendships are not sexual. It might come as a surprise to many in our society, but the great majority of friendships are not sexual, whether they're between men and men, women and women, or men and women. Most friendships are not sexual. And David and Jonathan's deep attachment, their deep devoted friendship of this with his great love, was not, of course, sexual. It was a kind of band of brothers friendship, born of men who served the Lord together, who fought together and served him together, and they were knit together, and they also had much in common. Friendship is built on commonality, on having things together that you do together, you enjoy together, attributes, personal characteristics that you share and so on, and that these bring people together in friendship, don't they? And we know then that David and Jonathan had such a commonality. We've considered David over the past couple of weeks. We've seen then his bravery and his skill as a fighter. He was a warrior, a successful warrior in, as he said, beating off lions and bears, but also then killing off Goliath. And he was also then a very popular man. We noted his interpersonal skills, the way he won favour even of Saul in his court. And with his success then, he won the wider favour of the people. So we didn't read them, but we have that refrain, that famous refrain of Saul has slain his thousands, but David's his tens of thousands, which of course was so galling to Saul.
and David later in life then. He was able to knit together as a fighting force, that band of fighting men, those valiant men, those mighty men. And these were strong figures. And bringing such people together and holding them together takes a strong character, a powerful leader. And this was David, and he was a popular man. He was a great leader, then able to hold this group of men together. And of course, as we've reflected on, he was a man of God. He was a man after the Lord's own heart, a man of valiant and strong faith in the Lord. But we know from the scriptures in Samuel that Jonathan was the same. Jonathan shared these characteristics I've just summarized that we've learned about David. Jonathan, too, then, was a mighty warrior. If you go back, we didn't have time to read all this, of course, this evening, to chapters 13 and 14. We read there of one of these other battles between Israel, the army of Israel, and Saul and the Philistines. Again, there's not much progress until Jonathan valiantly breaks the deadlock. He leads forth a fighting force and he single-handedly kills a whole bunch of Philistines and begins the rout of the Philistine army. He showed there, he showed later, that he too, like David, was a warrior, a valiant man. But in that defeat then of those rivals, of those Philistine soldiers then, he showed his confidence in the Lord, one of those great statements of faith that many of you will know, as we have it in 1 Samuel 14 and verse 6. We read Jonathan declaring, "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. And when he said that, they were few. It was him and his shield bearer, the two of them going up against this Philistine outpost. And they routed it because they had confidence in the Lord and they had confidence in their own military skills, their fighting ability. And Jonathan, like David, was also a popular man. He was a popular man, not only with his shield bearer, who clearly was dedicated to him, but we read in the aftermath of the battle that Saul, who had made this really stupid vow, commitment saying, look, nobody's to eat any of this food when you're fighting, and Jonathan had broken that, then they protected him. These men were loyal to him. They protected him from Saul. And he was then a great leader of these men. He led them forth, not just his shield bearer, other men into battle. And as I said, he too then was this man of faith, this man of God. So he and David then had this natural friendship because they shared these different personal characteristics, these different skills and abilities and personal attributes that helped them be knit together, especially then their common commitments to the Lord. And so David then seeing this, for Jonathan then seeing this in David, he is knit to him, loving him as his own soul. That's great language, isn't it? Loving him as his own soul. And it's reminiscent of that second great commandment, isn't it? To love your neighbour as yourself. Jonathan then loved David in that kind of way. A wholehearted commitment, loving David as his own soul, as himself. And David loved him back. So it was then his friendship was a natural one for these reasons. But it was also an unnatural friendship. I mean, at one level, it can be said to be unnatural, or some would say it would be unnatural, because these men were of quite different ages. Now, I've got the ages spelled out, but it looks pretty much like Jonathan was 25, 20 years older than David. He was an older man, but nonetheless, he formed this deep friendship with Jonathan, the older man, formed this deep friendship with the young man, who was still only a teenager at this point. But I don't want to think about that too much. That's not spelled out for us. It's not emphasized. But what is emphasized is that makes a friendship unnatural is that these men were deadly rivals, weren't they? Or potentially deadly rivals for the throne. We know, because we've been thinking about these last couple of weeks, that David then is the Lord's anointed. He is the one that God has chosen and through Samuel anointed to be the next king of Israel after Saul. But Saul's son Jonathan would have a claim on the throne. And he knows that. And everyone, in fact, knows that. Now, at this point, of course, Saul is the first king of Israel. There's no pattern established of you passing the kingship down the family to the oldest son. But as in our own country. That was the normal practice in the countries of old as well. The countries around Israel, that's how kingship was passed on to the oldest son. And you remember, as I said last week, that Israel, when they asked for a king, they said, we want a king like the other nations. And if the other nations, if their kings then succeeded one another in the family line, then they would surely expect that Jonathan would succeed Saul in the family line. And we've read words from Saul there that says much the same thing, that you are going to be, if you, why are you supporting David? It's going to be your kingdom after me. What are you supporting David for? And we know later, after Saul and David have been killed on Mount Gilboa, as we read at the end of this book, that Abner, then the commander of the Israel's army under Saul, he places Ish-bosheth on the throne, this rather feeble character. But he was a son of Saul. He was a surviving son of Saul. And so he puts him onto the throne because that is what was expected. And so Jonathan knows and David knows that they are rivals for the throne, rivals for the kingship after Saul. And we know, anybody who reads history knows that men who are rivals for the place of ultimate power tend to fall out, and often fall out very badly, whether they are politicians in our days vying to be prime minister, or whether they are kings of England or Scotland in the past. They're forever fighting and trying to kill each other, these rivals for the throne, aren't they? And it was, of course, the case in those ancient countries as well, whether they be kings of Babylon or Assyria or Egypt. You read those histories and these rivals are forever trying to kill each other off. So David and Jonathan were deadly rivals, and this made their friendship a really difficult friendship. It made it an unnatural friendship. There were these natural things to draw them together, but there were then these powerful forces as rivals for the throne pushing back against this. And therefore, second point about this friendship is that it was a costly but a faithful friendship. It was a faithful and costly friendship, and it was especially costly then for Jonathan. It was especially costly for Jonathan. So in what we read there in chapter 18 at the beginning of the friendship then, we have Jonathan and this incredible, I think, display of humility. He takes off his robe, he strips off his robe, and he gives it to David and his armour and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And the symbolism is very powerful, isn't it? What's going on here? At this point, we don't know explicitly that the news that David is the next anointed has leaked, but it would seem pretty likely that it's not going to take long for the news to get out that Samuel has anointed this man, David, to be the next king. And certainly by chapter 20, it's very well known. Saul learns about it, Jonathan knows about it, and so on. But I think Jonathan can see this here. And he submits to the Lord's will on this. He, the great rival, he submits to this. And we know from elsewhere in Scripture that this symbolism that I've described it is indeed that. So, for example, back in the book of Numbers, chapter 20, Aaron, as he's nearing his death, he takes off his priestly garments and he places them, or has them placed, on Eleazar, because he's handing over the high priesthood to his son, and that's symbolized by passing on these garments. We remember Elijah, when he's calling Elisha to be a successor, he takes off his robe and he puts his robe on Elisha to say, this is the man who's going to succeed me as the leading prophet. He's my successor. And there are other examples then where this taking off of a robe and passing this to another man is to show people that this is the one to succeed. And Jonathan then, in this amazing display of humility, in this powerful position, the crown prince at the court who's won this great battle, but he knows what the Lord's will is, and he knows that, and he hands over these to show to David he's submitting himself to David, his potentially deadly rival. He's submitting to him and saying, you are going to be king, not me. It's a tremendous act from Jonathan, isn't it? And then Jonathan acts to save David's life, doesn't he? We read this first of all in chapter 19. Again, we didn't read this then earlier on, but at the beginning of chapter 19 then, Saul, paranoid about David with his slaying of the tens of thousands and so on, Saul then wants to kill David. And Jonathan then goes and intercedes for David before Saul. Jonathan says to David, "My father Saul seeks to kill you, therefore be on your guard in the morning, stay in a secret place and hide yourself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak to my father, and if I learn anything, I tell you." So David then hides, like we read in chapter 20, where it's repeated in a slightly different way in this field. And Jonathan speaks well, we read in 19 verse 4, of David to Saul. "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he's not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took with his own hand and struck down the Philistine, and the Lord worked a great salvation for Israel. You saw it, you rejoiced." And we read then with this intercession that Saul listened to his son Jonathan. He listened to him and swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And so David was able to return, for a while at least, to the court. And again, this is a tremendous thing for Jonathan, to say his potential rival, David. And instead of seeking the opportunity to back his father's will and go and kill David, he does the opposite. He pleads for him and he pleads successfully for him. This is a powerful and costly thing to do, and it becomes even more costly for Jonathan in chapter 20, which we read, doesn't it, where again we have this, whether Jonathan, as some people think, was not around when his father is trying to kill David again and doesn't know about it, or whether David's right in saying he's hiding it from you, his desire to kill me. Jonathan can't believe it. I mean, his father has just sworn by the Lord. His father has sworn by the Lord he's not going to kill you. Surely you can't be right, David. He can't be wanting to kill you again. Surely he's sworn he won't do this. David says, "You know, I'm afraid it is the case. Let's just prove it. Let's go and test it," so that they work out this scheme that we read about. And Jonathan again goes. And he goes then at personal risk to himself, doesn't he? Both their lives are at risk here. Both these rivals' lives are at risk. Jonathan again, the temptation that his father puts into him and reinforces would be, you know, he could get a band of men and go and kill David, or he could let his father go and kill him as he wanted, but he doesn't. At cost to himself, he again pleads for David, and it's very much a cost to himself because his father then tries to kill him. Saul, as you read, is pretty useless with his spear. He keeps missing, and he misses Saul on this occasion instead of David, but he's trying to kill him. He's so angry with his son. And you think then of the difficulty for David, for Jonathan here. Tremendous tension for Jonathan. A tension here between the first and fifth commandments, isn't there? For Jonathan. On the one hand, he wants to honour his father. He wants to maintain a relationship with his father, however unstable, however angry and murderous his father is, he's still his father. He wants to maintain that relationship. And every time he goes and pleads for David like this, he's jeopardizing that relationship. But of course, at the same time, Jonathan, as a man of God, wants to please the Lord. And he knows that David is the Lord's anointed. He knows then that David is the one to succeed. And so he needs to honor the Lord by looking after David, his friend. And so he has to work through this tension that he does in chapter 20. And he works it through successfully because through the rest of his life, Jonathan remains at Saul's court and he remains with his father to the end, and he's killed with his father on the battlefield. So he maintains his relationship with his father in these very difficult circumstances at cost, and he maintains his relationship with David, a very costly relationship. But it was also costly later for Jonathan. He remained, for David, he remained faithful to this relationship as well, didn't he? Because you remember then that David then said that Jonathan made him say, "Look, you know, when you become on the throne, I don't want you to go killing me or all my family. I want you to look after us all and not engage in this pogrom, this act of genocide." And David was faithful to that, wasn't he? When David became king, he did not seek to kill any of Saul's family. Many of them were killed, like Jonathan and Saul himself, but David didn't seek any of them to kill them. And once his throne had been established, we read how he did the opposite with Mephibosheth, don't we? So in 2 Samuel chapter 9, once his throne had been established, he wants to honour his now dead friend David. He wants to honour the commitments they'd made to each other. He says, "Is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And so they say, yeah, there is this poor chap, you know, Mephibosheth, who was jocked and his legs were broken when he was a boy and he can't walk properly and so on. So this crippled man, he's Jonathan's son. So David thinks, oh, great, you know. So he summons him to the court. And of course, when poor Mephibosheth comes, he's trembling with fear because he thinks David's going to do what all the kings normally do and kill off the family of the opponent. But he doesn't, of course. David then says, no, you're going to sit here. You're going to be in the palace. I'm going to provide all your food. More than that, I grant you all the estates, all Saul's estates. And I grant you all these servants, Ziba and all those servants. These are all given to you. There's a cost to David in doing all this, but he honours then this friendship through thick and thin. So this friendship of David and Jonathan, this wonderful friendship, was natural for the reasons we've thought about. It was unnatural because of their potential deadly rivalry, and it was maintained faithfully by each of them through all these immense pressures. It was to be a hugely costly friendship. But there's a third point then, and this is a, I think, a very, very important point. It is that this was a godly covenantal friendship. This is a godly and covenantal friendship. Because we've noted then that in this friendship, there were these immense forces at work that would destroy this friendship, that would break this relationship, this deadly rivalry they had for the throne. This rivalry that Jonathan must have, to some extent, felt himself. The temptations that David himself perhaps experienced to engage in a pogrom with a rival family. But most of all, we do know then that other people played upon. That Abner, as I said, with this Bosheth, and so on. Saul himself saying, look to Jonathan, you know, you're never going to be king. You know, you should go and kill Jonathan, he says at one point. You should do this. So these tremendous forces acting to destroy this relationship. And we know then, as I said, that these were men of God. They were godly men. But they, particularly, I think, Jonathan, didn't say, well, we're both men of God, so it's bound to be fine. It's bound to be fine, you know, we're good godly men. We can resist these forces and remain friends together. That's not what they did. To resist then the powerful destructive forces that would destroy their relationship and potentially destroy their lives, they covenanted together before the Lord. And we read three times then of the, I'm not sure if it's one covenant or three covenants, however you want to read it, but they committed three times that we read of to these covenants together, committing then that they would look after each other. So we read a couple of them, first of all in chapter 18 and verse 3 then. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And we pick up on that in chapter 20, where we read, and verse 8, where David then says, deal kindly with your servant, saying to Jonathan, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. So Jonathan and David have sworn a covenant before the Lord with each other, says Jonathan, and says David. They know this is how they are pushing back against these pressures. In the presence of God, these men of God self-consciously have said, I am committing myself to look after you, and you are committing yourself to look after me. We're binding ourselves together before the Lord under oath to maintain a friendship, to maintain a relationship, a loving, devoted relationship together. So they have this first covenant there. Then again, as we read later in chapter 20, verses 14 to 16, we read, if I'm still alive, then says Jonathan, show me the steadfast love, covenantal language of the Lord, that I may not die. Do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever. when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan sees this danger. Don't cut off my family. And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. So he's saying it's not just with you. The danger is bigger than that. It's with the house, with your family. Saying, may the Lord, again, it's a covenant, self-consciously before the Lord, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And David made, and Jonathan made David swear again by his own love, because he loved him. And we pick up this again at the end of chapter 20 in verse 42, where we read, Jonathan says to David, go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. So again, then, there is this serious covenantal commitment in the presence of the Lord that David and Jonathan make to each other. And it's self-consciously made because they're aware of these potential destructive forces. Jonathan's aware of the temptation that David will have of wiping out his household. And so he says, make this covenant. They swear this covenant together. He knows that at the moment he is, Jonathan is the one who's in a more powerful position and could eliminate David and so on. But later the tables, he knows, are going to be turned when David's king. And he now wants them to swear together. They will look after each other and protect one another. And then finally in chapter 23, we read then of another covenant that they make together. So in this occasion, by now then, David has been on the run for some time. He's out in the wilderness at Horesh, and Jonathan goes to find him at Horesh. And we read, and Jonathan strengthened his, David's, hand in God, and he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. The Lord's going to protect you. You're not going to be killed, because you shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this. And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. So again, they're committing in the presence of the Lord, not once, not twice, at least three times, these deadly rivals, these potentially deadly rivals, commit to each other as men of God in the presence of the Lord, because they know that this is the kind of strength, the kind of force they need to oppose them, those destructive forces who have destroyed their relationship together. So covenants, the covenants we have here then, they're not for every kind of friendship, but there are situations when they're wise and right, aren't they? And we use them in a couple of common situations like this, don't we? We use them in marriage. Marriage is a covenant before the Lord. And it's a covenant before the Lord for the same sorts of reasons that David and Jonathan made covenants together. That there are powerful forces seeking to destroy marriage. All kinds of forces that push upon men and women in marriage, that would seek to ruin their marriages and tear them apart and destroy their relationship. And so a marriage ceremony involves when swearing before the Lord in the presence of God to commit to each other till death us do part and so on. There's commitments, because this kind of commitment, this serious commitment before the Lord, is what's needed to help oppose those destructive forces that would destroy a marriage. That's why we do this. And it's why churches like ours make covenants as well. Now, personally, I think we should do this more often. But when people come into membership, you've seen it, you know, people come up here and they stand here and they swear commitments in the presence of the Lord and the congregation to the other people in the church and to the elders and so on. They swear commitments then to show the seriousness of coming together in our church as members working together in the service of the Lord, because we all know churches can fall out, that division can creep in and be so damaging, that there are these destructive forces again that can ruin and destroy churches. And so again, godly churches wisely then want to establish covenantal commitments before the Lord to create a power of force to oppose the destructive forces that would tear churches apart. And I think it would be a good thing if we did it more often to remind ourselves, to help bind ourselves together more self-consciously, covenantally, so that we unify more strongly against these destructive forces. So then the friendship of David and Jonathan was this natural and wonderful friendship of deep and lasting love. And it lasted in spite of their rivalry and the tremendous forces, at great cost, especially to Jonathan. He was faithful. David was faithful. But what underpinned that commitment and faithfulness and success of their relationship, their friendship over those years, was the fact that before the Lord, they'd committed covenantally together again and again so that they could maintain before the Lord, as godly men, this deep and lasting friendship.